Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
In this Australian Investors Podcast episode, I'm chatting to Renee Condalis, Senior Financial Advisor at Perpetual. Renee deals with high net worth individuals and families and charities. In this particular episode, I want to draw your attention to the show notes, where you'll find a case study. You see, I gave Renee a set of circumstances and a fictitious example, which she can then pull apart and put back together. As you'll find in this case study, there are all the usual questions you might ask a financial advisor who is as experienced as Renee. Things like the difference between unlisted and listed asset classes, whether to buy direct shares or whether to use a mutual fund or managed fund or an ETF. Which is better? Why? What does she think? You'll find the full case study in the description of this podcast episode. I encourage you to read that and then have a listen to what she has to say. I hope you enjoy this episode with Renee Condalis of Perpetual. Renee, thanks for taking some time to join me on the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to be recording in person in Sydney. It's always nice.
Yeah.
Sun's out. There is a bit of scaffolding going on across the road. So apologies, dear listener, if you do hear that. There's not much we can do about it today. But we're going to be talking about a bit of your story, how you came to be involved in advice and doing what you do. Then we've got a fictitious couple that have this scenario, which I'm going to throw at you. And I'm going to pepper you with a bunch of questions around things like charitable giving, setting yourself up for retirement, how you build a portfolio, and things of that nature. It's going to be a bit of fun. It's going to be quite conversational as well. But I actually do have a few really cheeky questions, just short answer questions if you're on a test. Here at the start, I might ask for your best and worst investment.
Oh. Well, we'll start with the best. I would say sort of in the heat of COVID, I was quite bullish on some finance stocks. So I went in and bought CBA, Macquarie and NAB, and they paid me off quite well off the back of obviously the rally that we saw. Mm-hmm. Worst investment, I would say Magellan Global Fund. I actually bought it at probably the most expensive price that you could pay. I was fairly green towards the investment world at that stage, and just through other people's experience with the fund, and at that point was quite respected in the market, I just jumped in and bought it at the high. And of course since then the price has kind of come off quite a lot on the merits of a few things. But yeah, I think my sort of takeaway and learnings with investment is, you know, where you've got a genuine interest, whether it's in a company or a fund, tends to pay off because it's something that you watch quite closely and you have you're something that you stay more up to date with. And that's important, particularly if you're sitting there making the decision of when to buy and when to sell.
Yeah, for sure. So you're obviously a financial advisor now. You work here in Sydney. You've done a few things around. You said you were on AusBiz not too long ago. You've done a few write-ups for Ladies Finance Club and things like that. I'm curious, was
financial advice something that you always wanted to do? How did you get into this?
Yeah, it actually wasn't the first thing that came to mind when I, you know, back in the sort of uni days. How it all sort of started was my old man was actually a futures trader.
Okay.
So at a very young age, I remember, you know, listening to, seeing sort of in his office, this screen sort of flash red and green and the computer making sounds like buy, 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 sell, sell, sell. and I was so curious and intrigued around what exactly he was doing. So yeah, I think, you know, at a very young age, I was exposed to financial markets. Then as I sort of got older, you know, with economics degree in school and then carried that forward with economics in uni. But I suppose, you know, you could argue that economics can be somewhat a little bit dry. And I think wealth management covers a lot of ground in respect to financial markets, you know, the macro piece, but it also deals with clients. And that side of it is what really attracted me to the industry. So yeah, it was kind of like a perfect balance between being able to, you know, make investment decisions, manage money, but then also ultimately sit down and build relationships with people and clients.
So that's the bit that you enjoy?
Absolutely, yeah. I love the markets aspect of it. I mean, there's never a dull day because markets are always changing and you've always got to be on top of that. But I absolutely love the journey that you build with people and being a part of their lives and, you know, understanding how they, you know, what's important to them and their families and all the sort of nuances around that. It all just kind of marries up together and, yeah, absolutely love it.
So you work at Perpetual today, right?
Yep.
What does a typical day look like insofar as, like, who are the types of clients that you're dealing with?
Yeah, for sure. So we work with quite a broad range of clients. I guess the consistent theme is, you know, typically they're quite successful individuals in what they do. They might be executives of, you know, ASX 100 companies, you know, family offices, you know, retirees that have sold a business. So we definitely work with quite a broad range of clients, but we tend to sort of work in that high net wealth, ultra high net wealth space.
Yeah, right. So imagine you get exposed to a lot of people that, like you said, have been successful in business or even investing generally and come from all walks of life. That's really interesting because it'd be great to learn from them, I'd imagine, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you get to speak to people that have done, you know, exceptionally well in what they've done, and you know, a lot of them have great minds and yeah, they're literally the best of the best of the best of what they do. So they, you know, definitely teach me a lot of things that I don't know about, particularly in their industry. So it's a bit of give and take, I think.
Yeah. You can lean into it and then give your advice on structuring and long-term investing.
Yeah.
So the big thrust of this episode and discussion today, the thing that I really wanted to talk to you about was basically I've got this fictitious couple, and I'll give you the rundown. And anyone that's listening and you want to read this, I know this was super popular when we did it about a year or two ago, where I had some financial planners on and we went through a scenario. So I'm going to give this to you, Renee, and it's going to be in the show notes for anyone that's interested. So this is the scenario. Lois is 59 and Clark is 62. Clark Kent, for those of you that pick up on that, is Superman. So they live in Parramatta. They have a $550,000 mortgage, two kids, 17 and 24. Lois is a journalist earning $110,000 plus super, and Clark runs a private security business. It's called Super Protection Proprietary Limited, estimated to be worth $5 million. The couple has approximately $1 million outside of super, and they've invested that in a smattering of things. You could think like unlisted funds, LICs, and a few ETFs and stocks, plus $210,000 for Lois and Super and $240,000 for Clark. Now, Clark believes he is a high-risk investor and currently manages a portfolio of funds and ETFs himself, so he's just a DIY. Lois thinks she's more conservative to balanced, but Clark kind of convinced her to go high-risk. And I imagine you see this a lot, Renee, but that's inside Super. And she's been happy with the decision because it's done well, I guess. You know, 2022 might have been a bit volatile for them. The only major goal they have is wanting to retire within 10 years and being self-funded and debt-free. So they've obviously got that mortgage there, which is a thing against that. they're not too worried about leaving much to their kids, but they would like to give back regularly and support their children with their first home or weddings and so on and so forth, probably in the next few years. They'd also like to travel modestly every few years. So I imagine like this is a couple that has a fair bit of money behind them. They've got a business, which is a big bulky asset. They've got a house, but it's got a mortgage. I guess let's, before we get to some specific questions here and how you would go like about making, formulating strategies, can you just talk us through, like, someone presents like this, what's the first step, like, in your advice?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, there's actually quite a lot of good information here that, you know, whether that's obtained through conversations with the client or another trusted advisor that they're working with, first and foremost is still having a detailed conversation with the clients around, you know, where they are today, what are their plans for the future, you know, what are their concerns, what keeps them up at night, and really start to build a clear picture of, okay, this is where they stand today and this is what they want to, this is where they want to get to in, say, 5 years' time, 10 years' time, and then, you know, play that out, say, 30. So I think it's really important not to overlook that first step of having a very detailed conversation with the client or the prospective client. Once we sort of build out that picture and we feel like we've got enough information, you know, a sort of sub step in that is building out the balance sheet. So, you know, the scenario that you've given me, obviously we've got some really good information with respects to the mortgage, the value of the company. I think it's really important to understand what their cash flow looks like. And that's probably a little bit light in the information that we've got. So really getting an understanding of how much they're spending today, you know, how much they're saving, and going forward when they say look towards maybe retirement or, you know, living in retirement, how much they might expect to spend, because that is a really big challenge for couples that, you know, during their working years, most of their time is spent working. So they're not actually, they don't have the time to sit there and spend the money that they're earning. But then when they tick over to retirement, they've got all this time, but they're not actually earning any more money in terms of their, you know, employment. So yeah, I think the cash flow component of this is really important. And that's something that whether you would gain that directly from the clients or if they've got an accountant that they work closely with, we would build that out. And then follow on with basically a bit of a proposal of how we're going to help them and how we're going to add value, because really it differs for every single client. There's no sort of cookie cut approach to personal advice. We have a lot of levers. We've got a lot of tools that we can help clients with, but some will be relevant and others won't. So sort of sitting down after we've had the first conversation and putting forward, hey, this is how we're going to help you, a high level idea of the strategy gives clients peace of mind that, okay, they can start to picture a plan and how they're going to move forward effectively to reach whatever goals they're trying to achieve.
Okay, so you have a couple like this. I imagine if this is their first time getting advice, I'd imagine that there is often the chance that there's a mismatch in risk profiles, but also goals. So how do you go about untangling that?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, Owen. There's no set way of managing that challenge. I guess it really does come down to how the couple see managing their wealth collectively together or separately. And what we, our, part of our role as an advisor is highlighting, you know, which assets are collective, what's segregated as their own, and managing it accordingly to the respective risk profile. So we can definitely have multiple risk profiles across their asset pool.
Okay.
There's no sort of set rule that, you know, they're deemed one asset, one risk profile for their entire wealth. It can be segregated, but it's definitely encouraged to sort of have them on a similar page. It does make things a little bit more streamlined and easier in the future, but it just comes down to, like I said, how strong each client feels about whether it's their risk profile or even investment preferences. Like I've had a couple come through that the wife is very, very conscious about, you know, avoiding gaming, tobacco, all that sort of nasty stuff.
Yep.
Whereas the husband is very much about the bottom line. So in terms of constructing the portfolio in that respect, we sort of sit there and agree upon which stocks or which companies can go in the portfolio and which ones don't.
Yep.
And we'll sit there and have a deep conversation around each of those before we determine which ones go in and which ones don't.
Okay. Would you say it's common for people to share like most goals, or would you say there's quite a bit of individuality when it comes to this type of scenario?
It really does vary from individual to individual and couple to couple. So I see a lot of couples that definitely share the same goals and objectives. They're heading in the same direction from a lifestyle and just overall kind of, yeah, life perspective. But then there's some couples that definitely have different interests, and that will drive what purpose or objective they have for their funds. So again, another example is the husband's very interested in philanthropy and contribute, you know, community involvement, and whereas the wife is not so much. So it really does differ between individuals and couples. But again, part of our role is to be able to accommodate that.
Mm. Okay, so here we've got, so at age 59 and 62, and they want to retire in 10 years, they've got a 550K mortgage, but they've got a good amount of investments outside of that. Super's probably, in my opinion, is probably lacking quite a bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. We don't realize I didn't put in a Clark's income, but we know that his business would probably be profitable with $5 million of sales or revenue. They want to be self-funded. And if they've got a property like this and they've got a business, I guess the question is, those are pretty lumpy. Is there any... And those stand out to me as big things. If we just think about this, would you say that, like, would there be anything in particular you might explore with those two assets?
In respect to the property and
the business?
Yeah. Obviously, we'd want to understand what the value of the property is in Parramatta.
Yeah.
And I guess as if it is quite a large home, you know, as they kind of get older, they might be thinking about the maintenance of that home. So there's definitely some options around, one, potentially downsizing and making a downsize contribution to the super. It's a great way to accelerate super.
Can you explain what that is?
A downsize contribution? Yeah. So between the age, I can't remember the ages, and depending on how long you've held your property for, you can make a lump sum contribution to your super.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes in as a, I think it's a non-concessional contribution.
Yep.
And each individual can contribute 300K each. So that's effectively 600K straight into super that, you know, once you move into pension phase, so long as you don't exceed the cap, will be tax-free. So it is a really powerful tool to accelerate people's super that is, you know, potentially quite low. I mean, the other option is, and I see this a lot with people that have, you know, quite sentimental or strong attachments towards the primary residence, is potentially renting it out for income. And that takes quite a lot of pressure. Well, not so much pressure, but it contributes to income, you know, as an asset that they're holding. So definitely two options there with the property. With respect to the business, again, there are concessions through the sale of small businesses, but I would definitely want to understand what, you know, Clark's intention is for this business and what his succession plan is. So, yeah, that's definitely the first step, is understanding what his succession plan is and then advising accordingly off the back of that.
We have a lot of people that listen to the show that run their own business. And over on our other channel, we the Australian Business Podcast, I spoke to a lawyer recently, a tax lawyer, and he was saying that there are some interesting, I guess, concessions up to $6 million for certain business owners to transition assets.
Yep.
When it comes to doing something like that, so unlocking the value inside a small or medium business, do you outsource advice for that? Like, do you get legal advice on that?
We have in-house legal consultants. So one of the benefits or the strengths that we have is their family office, and they deal with these type of clients every day that are selling their businesses. So yeah, that's something that we have in-house.
Yeah, because I imagine that's a common thing, like whether the person wants to have one of their children continue, if not, is there someone else that they can sell it to? You know, maybe there's an investor that would buy it.
Yeah.
Or even buy part of it. That's maybe a huge weight off, in this case, Clark's shoulders. And given that they've got a 10-year window, maybe there's time to do something there.
Yeah.
Do you think, just eyeballing this really loosely, do you think that they could maybe achieve their goal of, say, you know, like a reasonable income in retirement, being self-funded?
Depends what you classify as a reasonable income in retirement.
What do most people set as kind of a minimum, would you say?
It varies. The type of clients that we work with, you know, they could be spending between 200 to 300K a year.
Yeah, right.
So it is very different depending on, the family. But I think the average would be be between, say, 80 to 90K a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that a couple like this could maybe go close to achieving something like that?
Yes, I do. I think with the right decisions made and putting certain things in place would substantially improve their situation. I think if they don't take certain steps, it can cost them a lot and would put a lot of pressure on their plan to be sort of self-funded and debt-free. But no, I do think, you know, assuming that at some point the sale of the business does occur and understanding what the value of the property is, all up, conservatively, I do think that they would, you know, be able to achieve their goals.
Yeah, which is great news for them. So I've heard people go into financial planning, into getting advice, and they come out and they're, you know, almost in tears because they didn't think that they could make so many simple decisions and have such a profound impact on their wealth. Mm. I guess one of the things that would be really interesting is, like, they've got obviously a mortgage, which they'd probably want to neutralize before retirement, which they could. Is they've also got this big pool of assets outside of super, so it's around $1 million, which they could also potentially do things with as well, right?
Yep.
Well, if someone did present with something like this, like a sizable amount of money outside of super, do any strategies pop into your head about what you could do?
Yeah. So, you know, keeping in mind that we typically advise to pay down non-tax deductible debt. So in the first instance, getting that mortgage down is the first step to take. Then outside of that, you know, the pool of money that you have sitting outside of super, there's two things to consider. One is how it's held and obviously what you hold. So, you know, if the couple are holding this in, say, their personal names, you would potentially want to explore what other entities might be more favorable for them from a tax effective perspective, because there's no point in, you know, investing in a portfolio if your house isn't in order or if the ship's leaking, because it's just going to cost you in tax. So definitely the structure is the first part, and then what we hold. So, you know, I think there's the fact that they've mentioned here, they've got some scattering of unlisted funds, LICs, ETFs and stocks. Probably want to understand, you know, what inspired them to hold those funds. We're not going to kind of go through and recommend removing all of them if there's a purpose for them in the portfolio, but really it's around, you know, taking a sort of sophisticated way towards building a well thought out portfolio, and there's, you know, a few steps and a few stages that you need to go through before we start recommending underlying investments in there.
From memory, I think more recent legislation, something, I don't know if you have this off the top of your head, so I might put it on the spot here a bit, Renee, but with people who have unused concessional contributions going into super under a certain balance, maybe also something to look at.
Yep.
Yeah, because then my understanding is that it's basically like carry forward with that. So people up to a certain balance inside super can make the most of that.
Yep.
And by doing so, claim a tax deduction too.
Yep.
So that's an interesting thing given their super balance is so low.
100%, yeah. You know, particularly because they're not at risk of breaching the cap.
Yep.
Bolstering or, you know, accelerating the super is also would 100% be a primary focus as well, particularly before they hit retirement.
Yeah. I'm hoping now we can kind of shift gears and imagine that we've gone through that initial stage where you've given them advice on the structure, maybe the portfolio is like ready for like a almost like a blank canvas, if you like. And so they want to get the, as you said, there's no holes in the ship and the thing is ready to be built. So over the next 10 years, one of the things that I think a lot of even, you know, non-financial people are realizing is that the old way that we thought about building portfolios, which was just bonds and stocks as a general kind of like two asset portfolio, that's probably not sophisticated enough for a lot of people, particularly people like this, where they might want different variations of portfolios. So like, or different, I guess, assets, sub assets within that. How do you think about that? I guess in like a lot of that, the literature and all of the fund managers love to put 60-40 portfolios on display and blah, 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 blah. Do you consider it through those two lenses of like risk on, risk off, or that do you cut it up again? Like a friend of mine does four, basically cuts into growth alts, defensive alts.
Yeah. We, on a sort of high level, definitely look at the portfolio in respect to attributes that contribute towards the growth sort of lens of the portfolio and then the defensive. But we do have sub sort of baskets or, you know, subcategories, mm-hmm. If you think about it like that. And then we do have sort of a special asset class, the alternative assets that contributes to both growth and defensive, but it has its own asset class of it, like it has its own asset class.
Mm-hmm.
So I would basically say that it is similar to the traditional 40-60 mix, but with an extra lens of alternative assets.
Yeah, right. What are examples of things that normally go into that bucket?
Yeah, so, you know, it could be something like private equity, private credit, infrastructure. These type of investments can be quite difficult to get a hand on directly. So we will pick the best breed of fund managers and construct basically a fund-to-fund portfolio that gives clients access to these type of things. Mm-hmm. They do tend to be fairly illiquid. So with respects to allocating money to this, the conversation needs to be had that, you know, in terms of liquidity, it's not something that you'll be able to access overnight or in 2 days. And I guess, you know, typically it would contribute towards between say 8-10% of the portfolio. So in that sense, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's not kind of the worst case scenario. But you know, all up what we've seen, particularly in recent markets, is that these investments have done what they're supposed to do. So that, you know, they've generated returns that have operated, you know, uncorrelated to equity markets, which is really pleasing to see.
Yeah, for sure. Particularly when now bonds are moving in the same direction as well, right?
Yeah, I think that's hurt a lot of portfolios over the last 12 months for sure.
Yeah. In terms of like one, we had Will Hamilton on the show not too long ago, and we talked about like different ways to express views when building a portfolio. One of the things is the debate, obviously, with active versus passive. And I'm just, obviously there are different instances and different clients will have different preferences, but just from where you sit, is there a preference for things like let's say we took global large cap, is there a preference there? Like global large cap equities?
Look, we don't discriminate against either. We will take an active approach where we generally feel that the fund will deliver alpha above market. So historically, or when you look at markets, typically the developed market can be more challenging to deliver alpha through an active fund manager. But we have seen, say, in small caps, there is an opportunity to deliver alpha through an active management approach. And that's because investors are able to have a competitive edge, whereas with the developed ones, it's the news is already out there. Like, a lot of it's already out there, and it can be quite challenging to really justify paying for an active fund manager when buying the market does the job really well.
Yeah. How about versus listed and unlisted assets? How do you think about, are there particular markets where you, particular markets where you might go unlisted versus listed? And I guess just any kind of context around why those would be unlisted asset classes?
So just to confirm here, when you say unlisted, you mean managed funds, right?
Yeah. Or even direct versus indirect exposure. So for example, we could have unlisted versions of listed products, but even if it's going direct with PE, you mentioned before, private equity, those types of things.
Yeah. Again, I think what will drive that is the asset class. So for the alternative space, unlisted 100%, because that's where the opportunities lie. But if you think about Australian equities, we prefer to go direct. And in fact, we actually prefer to hold the underlying companies rather than the managed funds. So that's something that we quite pride ourselves on. We actually have an in-house direct equities team that sit there and go out and meet the companies, talk to the boards and stuff like that. So I think it will be driven around the asset class and also the preference of the client. Some clients have held direct stocks or have held companies and inherited companies from their parents, and they have quite a strong attachment towards these companies. Obviously, part of our role is to advise them appropriately on whether we think that they should hold it or sell it, but we can also accommodate that direct exposure if we're buying and selling stocks in the portfolio.
How about then, one of the things that I'm getting a lot of questions on lately is hedged versus unhedged. Late in 2022, currencies fluctuated, particularly the Aussie dollar. Was really sunk. How do you think about that? Are there any rules of thumb, or does timeline or time horizon come into account when you make this decision?
Definitely the client's time horizon and their risk appetite. That will definitely drive, how much you would allocate towards hedged versus unhedged. The typical rule of thumb that we use is about 50% of the portfolio. But of course that will change, depending on the horizon and the risk appetite of the client.
Yeah, because this is one where obviously the hedged products often cost a little bit more, than the unhedged.
And
so, what I've seen is that it seems to be the longer time horizon tends to skew people towards unhedged. Is that probably a fair assumption?
Yeah, I would say that is a fair assumption. In the short run, you're sort of looking for them to kind of offset each other. Prices are moving around quite a lot. But in the long term, if you make a strong stance on, say, hedged, it can definitely reward you in the sense of, producing extra return on the back of a currency play. So I would agree with that for sure.
So there are a couple of specific questions here that I'd like to ask you, because I know you have a lot of experience in this regard. And one of those is charitable giving. So in this scenario that we had, the couple was quite keen on giving, and I imagine there are different ways to do this. Some people like to give when they're immediately, others over time, others after their time is up, so I guess maybe generally speaking, how have you gone about this in times gone by?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, there's, like you said, there are many different ways that people can think about giving to communities. You know, some people just like to make a donation. Mm-hmm. Others want a bit more structure, a bit more, you know, formal framework around their giving, and also, you know, the level of involvement, not just now, but over time, that they have with the community. So when you think about the different structures that, you know, we can set up for families or individuals that are, you know, probably a little bit further down their community involvement, there are different structures such as a PAF.
What does that mean?
A private ancillary fund, which is what, you know, in layman's terms is a private foundation. We also have endowments. So that's where you kind of sit in between making a donation but not really ready to set up your own foundation. You can give X amount of money that is held basically with Perpetual, and they invest the money for you. It's, like I said, it sits in between sort of that direct donation and, you know, having a full-fledged private foundation.
So what would the, is there a tax benefit to that? Like with the endowment being, that is it, would it be a separate legal entity?
It would be a separate legal entity. And it basically can offset your tax liabilities. There's definitely a lot of, benefits in respect to, tax benefits.
Yep.
The actual distribution is tax-free. So it helps, clients that tend to sit in that high net wealth space. Obviously, the intention isn't from a tax perspective, but it definitely sweetens it as well.
For sure it does. How about charitable trusts? Is this something that you've come across or have had involvement in the past? I don't think we've ever mentioned them on the show.
Look, I haven't had too much involvement with the charitable trusts. Our clients tend to have the private foundations. They're looking to be a part of communities over a long period of time, and therefore they feel having, you know, the private foundation where they're distributing directly to these communities works best. It also gives them more control around, the values that they want to set for the foundation, how they want their family to get involved, because really, this is a very powerful way of, thinking about how your children and your grandchildren are going to get involved with making financial decisions. What I've seen in the past is a couple that are sort of looking to bring their children into making decisions with respect to the significant wealth that they have. And the way that they've done that is actually through their foundation first. Mm-hmm. And then over time, you know, once they've come up that sort of education curve, involve them in other decisions outside of the foundation.
Mm. So a lot of people listening to this probably seems like a different planet to them, but it definitely isn't for you. So I mean, like, when you deal with clients that have created a significant amount of wealth, whether it's through business or whatever they do, are there some sort of, I guess, challenges and or opportunities that come with having, say, $10 million versus $1 million?
Yeah. So basically the opportunities that come, with someone that has about, say, $10 million to invest is it opens the door to, I guess, investments that you wouldn't necessarily be able to invest in if you were, say, a retail investor. So, the things that we were talking about before in respect to the unlisted investments, particularly in the alternative space, those are definitely opportunities that, clients with 10 mil can access. Mm-hmm. But then come, obviously, there is a higher degree of liability with that degree of money. So I guess the challenges that, part of why we're employed to work with these clients is, the structuring, the tax liabilities that they face. So having a strong team around them, you know, whether that's your financial advisor, your accountant, your legal consultant, working basically hand in hand to make the right decisions, both from a return perspective, but then also a tax perspective as well.
Yeah, because like you said, the liability is not necessarily like when people hear that, probably think legal liability, but there's a lot of downside too, right? Like preservation becomes ultimate.
Absolutely, yeah. What I typically tend to find, you know, clients that have significant wealth tend to be a lot more risk adverse than clients with, say, $1 million to invest. I think, you know, they've worked incredibly hard to, you know, build, say, a successful business that they're now looking to sell. And really what they want to do is protect that capital first and foremost. So, you know, our investment philosophy is literally protect and grow. And first and foremost, it's around protecting that capital. So, you know, you won't see us ever investing in anything too exotic because, you know, at the end of the day, clients want their money in a safe pair of hands.
Yeah, for sure they do. Hey, so this brings us probably to the end of the conversation. I'd love to pick this up again in the future, but if people wanted to reach out to you and find you, you know, and seek out your advice, where would they go to do that? Like, is there a way that people tend to get in touch with you? Or
Definitely via LinkedIn is a great way to make contact. I'm also happy to provide my email address on in the
show notes.
Or just give me a call. I'll provide my contact details as well.
Yeah, great. And you'll find all of that of how to get in contact with Renee in the show notes. So, yeah, I really appreciate you taking some time to join me across town here in the office with a bit of scaffolding going on in the background there. No, it's been great. And I'm guessing a lot of people that listen to this that are in a situation where they've got businesses and they've got substantial assets like property and that, and they're thinking about retirement. I mean, there's so much low-hanging fruit that can be, you know, harvested and made into something really special for people. So, just thanks for taking some time to share your wisdom with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own,
was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 RASC community members have begun the RASC plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by RASC, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RASC Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASC Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASC Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASC Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000. And hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASC and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASC network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.